This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. And today I'm joined by Dr. Shifra Aiken, who teaches at the Department of Irish and Celtic Studies in Queen's University, Belfast. Dr. Aiken completed her BA in European Studies at Trinity College, Dublin, and then went on to study for her MA and PhD at the National University of Ireland, Galway, after which she also worked as a Fulbright scholar before coming to Queen's. Dr. Aiken, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Aidan, for having me.
Sure. So we're here to talk about your book, Spiritual Wounds. And I might start by just having you tell us, what is this book about?
Yeah. Well, essentially, I was always interested in the fact that the Irish Civil War was followed by this idea of silence, particularly growing up, that it was too contentious to speak about, that so many veterans and public figures preferred to let sleeping dogs lie, I suppose, and to relegate this to the realm of oblivion, I suppose. So really what I wanted to do is to explore this idea of the silence and the myth of silence. And I started off by compiling lists of works that had addressed the Civil War. And what I realized quite quickly was that there was a huge wealth of material that hadn't been really scrutinized in any comprehensive way previous to this. And then the project really developed because of the wealth of the material. So I started off gathering any kind of accounts relating to the Civil War. But I was able to narrow it down for the book then, and I was able to focus solely on veteran testimonies based on first-hand experience, but looking how a lot of veterans actually wrote about their experiences in indirect ways and coded ways, and particularly by adopting fictionalized forms. So essentially the book is an exploration of that tension of how there were these calls to forget the Civil War, the contentious events of the Civil War, which was in 1922 to 23 at an official level, and how those calls to forget were matched by a real unwillingness to accept that reticence, but that many veterans had to adopt creative ways in order to address their experience because of this emphasis on silence.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about, like, how memory and forgetting always go together. A lot of my work, as well as being in Irish studies, I've done a lot of work on Israeli history. And there's a kind of a famous phrase that David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, made once, where he was talking to a group of recently arrived immigrants or refugees, whatever you want to call them, from Morocco, who were Jewish. And he said, "You must forget that you are Moroccan, just as I have forgotten that I am Polish." Which, if you know anything about logic, is sort of, you can't forget something if you're saying that you remember it. And that whole thing of, like, memory and forgetting has become very popular, I think, in Irish studies in general. So I'm wondering, how do you feel your work adds to that? Or what are you doing that's new? What are you doing that's building on what's come before?
Absolutely, yeah. I was able to draw on what had come before. I suppose there has been an explosion maybe in memory studies in recent years. Una Frawley in particular in Irish studies has been really central in terms of putting together a number of edited collections. And what's interesting with the memory studies field is that it's very interdisciplinary, and it's looking both at scientific models of how memory operates, as well as looking at various forms of literature and creative responses and ways of means of representation, I suppose. But when I was we're working on the project, actually, Guy Biner also published his really significant book, Forgetful Remembrance. And what Guy Biner has done essentially in the international field of memory studies is he's shifted away from an emphasis on memory to an emphasis on forgetting, and I suppose put together methodologies in order to unpack this idea of forgetful remembrance, that what communities do when there are these uncomfortable memories, and how that they are on one hand repressed, but that they linger on in these non-conventional ways. So I was able to tap into that in a way, because that really spoke to the project that I was working on, and that work has been really significant. I suppose in terms of what I do and how is it different, I think what this book really is about, there's memory, there's forgetting, there's marginalization, but it's a testimony, I think, and trauma, and that's the subtitle of the book, it's Spiritual Wounds, Trauma, Testimony in the Irish Civil War. But that's what is my interest here. So that idea of testimony is an account that reflects on often from personal experience, but also that is presented to the public with some kind of maybe moral or ethical concern. There's a political meaning oftentimes behind a testimony in its presentation to the public. So I was interested in that. And I suppose what I've done is I've probably broadened understanding of what testimony is. And I think this is something that maybe will be picked up on, and people have different ideas on this, but I suppose testimony can be seen as quite traditional in that it should be first person testimony and fit within certain generic, I suppose, categorizations. What I'm looking at here is how testimony can be found in very obscure ways, in obscure forms, particularly in fictionalized forms, and that brings up all sorts of questions, because if a testimony is meant to attest to something that's true and be presented in the public sphere as a true account, then how does that operate when it's under a layer of fiction? So that's something that I had to grapple with. But what I did for this book is broaden that idea of testimony to look at all of these unconventional forms that veterans use in order to testify to their experiences. And then I suppose in terms of trauma, trauma I think is a very tricky field and tricky topic to grapple with. It's again, it's something that is quite dominant now, particularly in, let's say, considerations of contemporary literature. And I think that it's often maybe used too carelessly as a term. So I think another thing that I was trying to do was trying to establish a framework for how to think of trauma in the context of 1920s Ireland, when the vocabulary of trauma didn't exist. So that it is quite a dangerous thing to do, to put later ideas and concepts in place in a historical context. But that said, the notion of trauma is so central to the legacy of the Irish Civil War that it is something that needs to be addressed. Why is it that the Irish Civil War is associated with trauma in the collective imagination anyway, to this day, and why veterans, even from the 60s on, were attaching the language of trauma onto the Irish Civil War. So it was used by veterans, but obviously not in the 1920s. So looking at that and how trauma is really political in terms of whose trauma is validated and whose trauma is not validated. And again, it's all about response to testimony. It's about who's responding to it and how is it received by the public, and how some people's stories are validated and some people's pain is validated, whereas others may have may struggle to be heard.
So I might ask you to talk a little bit more about these kind of two interrelated themes of what is the political meaning of these testimonies and the fact that they're all very first person personal narratives. One thing I found very fascinating about the text you use, but also perhaps a little bit odd, is that they're Civil War texts, right? So they're either written in the context of written in the time of the Civil War, or they're actually direct memories of the Civil War. But they don't ever seem to devote too much attention to a lot of the conventional political issues that we associate with the Irish Civil War, right? They don't talk, it seems to me, at least from the way you analyze them, they don't talk about, you know, the oath to the king or partition, or like Ireland's international status or the treaty ports. And they seem to focus way more on sort of interiority and personal trauma, as you say. So why is that? Is this another kind of forgetting where they're kind of leaving aside conventional political questions in favor of these individual emotional questions? Or do these still remain kind of political texts in some way?
Mm. So it's the first thing I would say is that these questions do come up in some of, let's say, the novels and even short stories, that there's often an impulse maybe to educate about the events of the Civil War, so they will be included. And what novels allowed veterans to do was to have multiple characters and give a kind of multivocal response to the Civil War and give different responses and reactions to the treaty debates and the split over the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. So there are sections definitely in some of the works. I'm thinking of Francis Carthy's novel, Legion of the Rearguard. There's a whole quite lengthy sections actually devoted to the political questions and leading political figures. Patrick Molloy similarly, but not to the same extent. But then there are others who don't opt for that at all. So I think what's interesting here is that these writers are concerned with conveying their own experience, and maybe their own experience and what they stands out for them, it doesn't tally with what we might be looking for based on what we've read in the history books, maybe. And particularly, let's say, the women's writings, there's less emphasis definitely on those big political questions, because they're more focused on the small questions. There's family splits, whether that's the domestic circumstances and so on. And then there's another interesting difference between some of these narratives. Some of these narratives will include historical figures and name drop, whether that's Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins, and others will go the opposite and not mention any historical figures. I'm thinking of Jim Phelan is an example. I think he mentions one historical figure, which is feminist activist Maud Eden, who's the only historical figure referenced in his novel from 1936. So I think it's something that that they are wanting to educate, but there are already maybe history books that they don't need to set out every single detail. But I think the thing to think of as well is what really runs through all of these texts and testimonies, even if they're not addressing the conventional political matters that we might associate with the Irish Civil War, is that these are highly political, and what's happening here is the personal is the political in these, the personal responses.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to assume that these are just non-political, because I don't think anything can be non-political, and certainly not if you're talking about a civil war. And your book has this structure of moving back and forth in alternating chapters between male accounts and female accounts. So is that kind of decentering of conventional political questions the only major difference? Or can you tell us more about how female accounts of the Civil War differ from male accounts?
Yeah, that was a tricky question, actually, Aidan, when I was working on the book and I finally decided, you know, to have a chapter on the main men's accounts and then followed by chapter on women. I'm still a little bit uncomfortable on that, because it still has reinforces some kind of hierarchy that the men's writings are addressed first. What I tried to do then in the later chapters was to address both men and women's experiences. And I suppose from my point of view, that is something that was important to do, because so often in mainstream accounts of the revolutionary period, the emphasis has been on the male experience. But then we've got fantastic scholars working on women's history, but often then the women's histories are separate books or separate studies. So I wanted to, I suppose, integrate this and maybe present a model for addressing a broader range of experiences within a single book, rather than dividing between let's say a book on men's experiences and a book on women's experiences and so on. But in terms of the women's experiences, really, really quite remarkable in terms of how they were pushed towards these less conventional forms of testimony, and I suppose the lengths again that they went to in order to document their experience. And I suppose the thing to say from the start is that women were highly active during the Civil War period, that they were able to, I suppose, assume roles that maybe they hadn't previously occupied in terms of within the Republican movement, and particularly women who sided with the anti-treaty side. And there was a strong association between the female activists of Cumann na mBan and the anti-treaty side. And then following the Civil War, and even during the Civil War, they suffered for that activism. The rates of incarceration of women were far higher during the Civil War than previously in the war against the British. And then with the establishment of the socially conservative free state, that radical element is really sidelined from the revolutionary amendments. And it was something that was quite uncomfortable, and it's actually still uncomfortable, which is something that still surprises me, I think, but is working on an oral history project recently. And it's actually a lot harder to get families to talk about their female relatives during this period, and that there's still maybe a discomfort around this idea that women had these active roles, that they were breaking, I suppose, conventional ideas of gender by assuming military roles or by aiding the IRA or by joining Cumann na mBan. And there's maybe a shame around that in some context. So what was interesting here was with the women, many women did want to document their experiences. They kept prison diaries, they wrote letters, they wrote memoirs, but securing a publisher was often quite difficult. And the only woman who published a full-length Civil War jail memoir was Margaret Buckley, who was published at the end of the 1930s. But before that, before the publication of that, there were all of these fascinating fictionalized accounts that had been published, and that really were overlooked. They didn't galvanize a huge amount of public debate, but really some are quite remarkable. Annie P. Smithson wrote a romance novel, and three chapters of it are essentially an account of her own Civil War experience. Really fantastic play then by Maureen Cregan, which is an account of a wife whose husband is on the Civil War, the big hunger strike, and at the end of 1923 of Republican internees at the end of the Civil War. And what's complicated here as well, and I'll just it's worth mentioning, is that even as these women are breaking silence and boldly testifying to these experiences, there's still maybe a concealment that they still feel, or are still, I suppose, grappling with, I suppose, and maybe a discomfort and a lack of self-assurance around their own, placing their own, I suppose, personal experience into the public domain. And Maureen Cregan is quite an interesting one, because although this play seems to be at least autobiographically based, given that it's dedicated to her own husband who was on this hunger strike, she was actually far more active than her female protagonist. She was at the time a messenger for anti-treaty Sinn Féin, and she was sent to Paris and Geneva in a really significant role. Yet she places her play in a domestic context, a much more traditional context. And equally, we find then with some of these women that there's double voicing occurring in the writing, so that there will be a very conservative aspect or conformist aspect to a story or an account that will then be a buffer for the more subversive subtext, I suppose. And Marie Nigroz is an interesting example of that in her short story collection, in that some of the stories, and it's on Verster Hargeskilt Ella, the two brothers in some stories and other stories, that some of the stories are quite conventional in their ideas of, let's say, maternal sacrifice within I suppose, a Republican imagination. But then there are other stories that are really critical of the hostility shown towards women within the institutions of the new state. And then equally, some of these women, though they were highly active and boldly testifying to this experience and critiquing the mainstream, some of them were also involved in writing maybe some more standard historical works, whether that be school textbooks, whether that be Dorothy McCardle, who wrote The Irish Republic, writing these texts that I suppose reinforce the established narrative while their other writings contested it. So it brings up really interesting tensions that just speaks to that discomfort that still is evident to this day around female activism.
Yeah, there's such a kind of an obvious and very blatant contrast between this idea that you start off kind of critiquing of this notion that no one wants to talk about the Civil War, and then just the sheer number of texts that you're able to uncover where they're directly talking about the Civil War. And obviously there's multiple voices, multiple kind of perspectives in these texts. Some are radical, some are conservative, there's male and female voices and so on. And obviously you could interpret those texts in a number of different ways, I assume. But one very interesting methodology that I really was fascinated by in your book is this use of like just people's handwritten notes in the versions of the books that you found. Why use that? What does that kind of source material do for you?
Yeah, you know, that was something I kind of wasn't sure whether I should use or not. But as the project developed, what I really wanted to do was to consider how these were received as testimonies, because testimony is something that is picked up on the other end. You know, a public story that's left in a drawer that's never shared, a private story, sorry, that's locked away in a drawer, never shared or destroyed before anyone reads it. That's not testimony. But these were placed into the public domain. So how did people respond to them in real time was something that I was really interested in, and I tried to uncover as much as I could. And I suppose one way of doing that was newspaper reviews was an easy way to do that, or other reviews. Another thing would be letters to the author, if there was an archive, which often there wasn't, but in some cases there were some letters to authors, maybe publishers' works again, if there was a peer review of a text and so on. But one of the things that I did come across then was the fact that a lot of these books were read by fellow revolutionaries when they were published. And they were a very keen audience who were willing to scrutinize, I suppose, these questions. So you would find copies of these books that have corrections written in on the margins, or question marks, or doubts. And I think that's to be expected. It's the Civil War. There's going to be all sorts of contesting responses and debates around this. And that's part of this as well, because by putting these stories into the public domain, these figures were taking a risk, and that's why they often adopted these self-protective strategies. But I think I remember that one of the first times that I came across marginalia that I thought was quite significant was in the National Library, a copy of Charlie Dalton's With the Dublin Brigade, which is an early memoir from the end of the 1920s, and the copy was donated by William O'Brien into the National Library, and he has, you know, notes throughout. And one of the things that struck me was that there's a reference in the book to one of our supporters. So I think it was the case that one of our supporters helped us during this period, and this would have been in the context of the War of Independence in Dublin. But the William O'Brien, who had the copy, wrote in that the supporter was Jenny Wise Power, who then was significant pro-treaty, one of the key, I suppose, women leaders on the pro-treaty side. But I thought it was quite interesting there that her name hadn't been mentioned in the original, yet the reader was reinserting it. And particularly think of how women's activism was often set aside, and how we're somewhat trying to reinsert that. And I wondered, was it coincidence that it was the woman's name who wasn't included, that she was rendered anonymous, I suppose, in the published work. So that was one example that I wanted to include. But then there was others that I just thought added to that. There's a great book called Ugly Brew, by it's a pseudonym, I think, but Jake Wynne. I've never been able to get to the bottom of who this was, but it describes the events of Dublin, the squad, and then the later the Civil War. But I managed to get a copy of that on ABE books online, secondhand copy. And what was fascinating there was the reader was quite skeptical of a lot of what had been written about. But I think that was maybe an indication of the, again, what I said, the risks that these individuals took. But oftentimes, even though there were maybe attentive audiences, these books could be quite harshly criticized in reviews because of what they were doing, that because of the fact that this was such a contentious topic, and the women's work was dismissed as being, you know, too clearly written by a woman, this romance fiction, you know, other works that were these novelized self-portraits by revolutionary veterans were heavily criticized sometimes according to very stringent literary standards, whereas these weren't necessarily high class literature, and that wasn't the intention. These are testimonies to personal experiences, but I suppose that was another way of silencing. If we think of all of the processes of silencing that run through the book, that's an aspect of it. There's censorship, there's even excommunication from the Catholic Church, but there is heavy criticism from the, let's say, the literary elite and even the historical elite as a way of maybe silencing and marginalising some of these works. So the marginalia was a way of maybe accessing the responses, and it's definitely something that I would do going forward, because I think it's really a fascinating way to get an insight in terms of readers' reception of these works.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in terms of basically where we find these kind of testimonies, I know you've done some work also on Ernie O'Malley, and he's quite a large figure in this kind of literature, right? Partly because he is just a very good writer. And he leaves Ireland after the Civil War, and that in a way becomes another kind of stereotype about the most radical people go into exile. And yet even the people that you're reading, that you talk about in the book, that stay in Ireland, they seem to feel that they're also in a kind of internal exile or something, or they're domestically exiled. What does exile mean for these people? Like, can you be exiled if you're still at home?
Yeah. No, that was something I was really interested in teasing out, because that's a concept that's used in other Civil War contexts as well. I studied Spanish actually at undergrad in the Spanish Civil War, and there's an important study on this idea of inner exile that's addressed in the Spanish context. And we see it then running through a lot of these writings. So on the one hand, you do have high rates of emigration in the 1920s. Both pro and anti-treaty veterans, particularly anti-treaty Republicans, felt that they didn't have the same economic advantages, that they were maybe less likely to be hired for jobs because of their Republican convictions. So high levels of emigration. And I've traced this, so just going through the nominal rows, but a lot of these patterns in the 1920s replicate patterns of emigration that had already been in place. That's the major areas that are affected by high rates of emigration are on the West Coast and the Western Seaboard, and that have strong traditions, I suppose, of emigration previous to this. And what's worth mentioning here is that during this period, a lot of the publishers were actually based outside of Ireland, particularly in London and so on. So in a way, these testimonies are being published in a diasporic context in some cases, and there was maybe a perceived view that there was more freedom maybe outside of Ireland to address maybe some of these experiences. And there was also actually a huge audience for these kind of writings in the UK. But just back to the question of exile, I was interested in how exile functions as a motif, I suppose, in these testimonies. And this exile motif has a long-standing, I suppose there's a long tradition of exile motif within the nationalist imagination. But what's interesting about that exile motif is that in a way it was redemptive, because during this period in the 1920s, early 1920s, the IRA actually banned emigration. And initially, veterans had to sign up for a foreign reserve list so that they would still be, I suppose, available for duty when they left Ireland. And ultimately, the IRA had to set that aside, I think, by 1927 or 1928, because it had no way of controlling, I suppose, the huge numbers that were emigrating. But I think there was still, nevertheless, a stigma maybe around emigration, or a shame around that. Yet this exile motif that went back for generations within the nationalist tradition was a way of overcoming that. But what's fascinating is that this exile motif isn't only in the accounts that appear outside of Ireland, but also in the works of revolutionary veterans who remained in Ireland. And some of them, you know, self-identified as exiles. And I think if we think of after any conflict, one of the main dilemmas in the post-conflict period is that return, that challenge of returning to civilian life, to a free war state, which is never going to be possible. You know, that these are men and women who went through really strained circumstances during this conflict, and the return is always going to be very difficult. There's also the question that comes up in terms of those who've been excommunicated from the Catholic Church, let's say, for their Republican convictions, and can't even return to their local churches, to their local communities, or that there's a stigma around them. So absolutely, there's this idea of what's referred to by some as spiritual exile, of inner exile, and maybe a difficulty in terms of adapting, or in terms of grappling with the new status quo. And partition is key to this as well, that there are of course minorities on both sides of the border that are left behind, that are mm-hmm. find themselves in a state that doesn't represent them necessarily. So I think that's another idea, I suppose, of exile, that is part of the consequences of partition.
So your book has obviously, I mean, has been very well received, and I think quite rightly so. As the kind of dust settles on that now, where will you go next? Do you think you'll stay working in memory studies, or what's next in terms of a research project?
Yeah, so it's funny actually, Aidan, because I think when you work on a book like this, you, in a way, by the time it comes out, you've already kind of you've already moved on in a year or two in terms of the research. But what I have been doing, and I would love to follow up with a second book, is tracing representations of the Civil War across generations as well. And I've actually an article really wrote maybe last summer, and I think it's out in the next few weeks, but going up right up to the present. And I think what's fascinating is that even though the book is just about veteran testimonies, we see a really interesting dynamic if we take a 100-year scale, because there's this idea that there was a silence around the Civil War, yet there are these silence breakers again and again and again who are addressing the Civil War, and often unaware of the fact that they are within this lineage of Civil War silence breakers. So I think that's something that I'm really interested in. I'm fascinated too just by popular literature, and I don't think it's something that maybe is looked at enough in historical studies, but how these historical events are replayed again and again in popular fiction. And I suppose that we have a really strong culture of that, of a reading culture in Ireland. And it's something to address, and even to celebrate the fact that there is such an interest among the general public. So that's something that I will be working on, I'd say, for the next years. But then another project I've been working on is totally unrelated, is looking at the Gaelic revival in Springfield, Massachusetts, and that's something I've probably been working on for about 10 years at this stage. So I kind of jumped project, so I'm hoping to go back to that. But what I'm trying to grapple with actually is I'm writing, I suppose, a biography of a relatively minor figure who was a Gaelic poet from Springfield, Massachusetts, who was originally from Kerry, and his attempts to create an urban Gaeltacht in Springfield. And I'm trying to, I suppose, use his story as a way of opening up and writing a case study of the community. So that's what I'm working on. And it's a really fascinating project because it's very much a history from below. It's trying to get as many source materials as you can. And this is somebody, again, who had no papers, there's no archives. So how do you, I suppose, reconstruct a history of a community that doesn't have, I suppose, that the access even to the idea that these are stories that would be ending up in an archive. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. So I'm hoping to get more time maybe this year to get working on that. So it's quite a different project, but in a way I suppose it ties together with a lot of what I've been doing in terms of the history from below, looking, I suppose, at the working class histories and again questions of gender. How do you write a male historical biography, but also I suppose bring up the experiences of, I suppose, the many women involved in these movements as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like how do you avoid just kind of deifying another man? Like it's always a risk. It does seem that like memory studies has become quite popular as a subfield within Irish studies. Is that just because of what we've been going through for the last 10 years and sort of going through a decade of commemorations that is just really pregnant with memory? Or is there do you think there's some other reason why this has become a really like thriving active field?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different reasons. I think it's an international trend, and I'm always keen to look at international studies. I think within the Irish context, there's definitely been a huge opening up around memory and trauma in relation to the institutions, and in terms of how could it be that so much abuse was ongoing in Irish society for so long and unacknowledged, and how as a society, and how, I suppose, as academics, do we work in to maybe redress some of these, if we want to call it the marginalization of memory, and how there has been a response to that. And there's various writings now coming up or being published from those who are victims in the institutions and so on. So I think that's probably responsible for some of that shift. And there's some really interesting work ongoing. And then, as you said, there's the decade of commemorations that's finishing up next year. So there's been a huge emphasis on revisiting the events of 100 years ago. And also, I suppose, critiquing how it's been commemorated and how the commemoration is so political and tied to contemporary events. And that's really probably emerged as a subfield within historical study, and maybe that wasn't the case a number of years ago, even though it has. And I think as well it really emerged from French historians who were much more pioneering in terms of memory studies and in terms of the First World War. So I think it's an interesting field. I do think sometimes with the memory studies, trauma studies, that for me anyway, I suppose I read up on a lot of the recent research because I'm really fascinated by it. But I think it is something that is challenging, and that when using these concepts, for me anyway, I always want to make sure that these concepts are actually backed up with very specific examples where we see these ideas working. And I would say too that sometimes some of the material, let's say internationally, wouldn't necessarily be as relevant to the work I do. So I would often read works that wouldn't necessarily fit in, and maybe that's important too, to kind of look at things that you mightn't necessarily agree with. I know one of the works that really helped me with this project on testimony was a US scholar called Tally Cowell, Worlds of Hurt. But for me anyway, what was interesting there was that she was looking at testimony from Vietnam, also from women who'd experienced domestic violence, also from the Holocaust, that idea of the, I suppose, the politics of testimony. But the emphasis on the political, I suppose, was central to her study. And maybe that's something that isn't the case in mainstream memory studies, trauma studies works, that there's often maybe a depoliticization associated with trauma. So I think that's something to bear in mind. But I think this field in terms of memory studies will continue to grow. And I think it is a field that should spark debate. And I think that's something that's very healthy and that people can bring in different approaches to it. And ultimately, it's just a slightly different way of addressing the events of the past, not as focused on what occurred as much as thinking about how all of these memories are mediated and processed through so many different forms, and ultimately that what we receive through the memory is something of a mediated version of the original, and whether we'll ever access fully the, if we want to call it, the bare bone facts of the past is another question. And maybe that's what we need to move towards, that idea that that history doesn't always give us straightforward answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so many fascinating questions here that we could start, probably spend years talking about. Thank you so much for this really great conversation. Spiritual Wounds, Trauma, Testimony in the Irish Civil War is out now with Irish Academic Press and is very much worth reading. Thanks, Shifra.
Thanks so much, Aidan.